Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Thursday, April 16th, and we're diving deep with today's macro, geopolitics, AI, blockchain edition. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex, and honestly, I'm already buzzing. We've got a lot to unpack. It feels like the global landscape is shifting in real time.
Shifting is putting it mildly. Let's start with geopolitical risks. Is a wider conflict in the Middle East now inevitable, and what does that mean for the already fragile prospects of a global recession?
It's a cascading risk scenario, Maya. Think of it like mineral crystallization, seemingly isolated pressures building until a sudden, dramatic formation. And the pressure is building. But we'll also be looking at how AI is poised to reshape enterprise and the surprisingly dark side of that revolution.
Dark side. You always find the angles, Alex. But speaking of big numbers, $40 trillion is the size of the private credit boom. Is it a lifeline or a looming crisis?
An excellent question, and one that connects directly to the immense infrastructure demands of AI. Then we'll unpack Saudi Arabia's increasingly ambitious global investment playbook.
And get this, India is now the place to watch in the AI space. Plus, we're digging into the potential of truly decentralized software creation.
It's a whirlwind tour, right? But that's what you expect from us. Let's get started.
Inflation in the US tripled last month, hitting 3.3% year over year, largely due to a $1.30 spike in gasoline prices in just 5 to 6 weeks. Let's talk about the economic fallout of the US-Iran conflict, because gas prices going up feels like a gross understatement.
It is fundamentally a recalibration of risk assessment across multiple asset classes. The initial market optimism we've seen, even with the truce, is dangerously complacent. Paul Dobson rightly cautions that a physical crunch in the energy space is entirely possible if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, and that's not priced into current valuations.
Complacent is generous. Wall Street seems to think this is a normal supply disruption, while countries in Asia are already rationing liquefied petroleum gas for factories. What's going on with the disconnect between financial markets and the actual economy?
The core issue, as Kevin Wurst pointed out, is we're applying universal models to a unique situation. Crude oil is currently the central correlation point for everything VIX, S&P credit spreads. The financial instruments aren't reflecting the real-world pain. We're seeing a $30 premium between dated Brent and ICE Brent, signifying the struggle to physically obtain supply.
So paper oil is fine, real oil is not. It's like pretending you have a sandwich when you're staring at an empty plate. And this isn't just about gas stations running low. What's the broader impact on trade, especially considering China's role?
China is absolutely central to understanding this. Its currency is undervalued by approximately 16% according to the IMF, and they have a substantial trade surplus. They're driving rapid innovation through government subsidies, creating overcapacity and, frankly, forcing even multinationals like Volkswagen to restructure. Disruption to global trade, particularly energy flows to China, exacerbates those existing imbalances.
Right, China shock too, excess production capacity forcing everyone to play by their rules. But how does that connect to Iran specifically? I thought this was about a geopolitical standoff, not a manufacturing crisis.
The conflict presents a novel incentive for China to mediate. It's a huge blast zone for their economy, agriculture, technology, shipping. More importantly, it complicates their own industrial policy. Disruptions to oil and key minerals impact their EV and solar panel production, directly undercutting their ambition to dominate those sectors.
So China needs a stable oil supply to keep its factories running and its trade surplus intact, and that makes them a reluctant peacemaker. Let's talk about the Gulf states. They've raised nearly $10 billion in bond sales this month. What's that about?
It signals a calculated effort to bypass scrutiny and accelerate fundraising, with a focus on speed over transparency. They're halting energy exports and need capital fast. This highlights a vulnerability. Countries' ability to pay for oil is becoming the challenge, not just obtain it. Victoria Craig's point about wealth-dependent vulnerability is critical.
Wealth-dependent vulnerability. That's a delightfully depressing phrase. So the problem isn't just a lack of oil, it's a lack of dollars to buy it.
And that's where the Strait of Hormuz comes in. Iran controlling passage gives them leverage, even the ability to collect a toll, which, as noted, the U.S. finds unacceptable. Susan Maloney highlights their strategic preparedness, successfully implementing a plan from the outset to achieve regime survival and gain leverage. It directly contradicts Trump's previous assertions.
Preparedness. They actually planned for this. I'm starting to feel like everyone underestimated Iran. What does that mean for the negotiation process?
It means Iran is unlikely to cede control of the strait entirely, recognizing it as crucial to its post-war position. The key sticking point, the nuclear enrichment program, is likely to be a temporary extension, not a permanent cessation. And increasingly, the Iranian leadership, dominated by figures from the security bureaucracy, is more hardened and less amenable to concessions.
So a limited deal is the most realistic outcome, but it doesn't solve the underlying problem of the Strait of Hormuz. What about Europe? They're consistently labeled as the most vulnerable region.
Jens Eisenschmidt frames it perfectly. The energy shock is a reminder of a deeper structural weakness, high electricity prices due to fossil fuel dependence. Consumption represents 50% of their GDP, amplifying the impact, and they're actively seeking a new business model as China gains market share. A downgraded growth outlook is almost inevitable.
Okay, so Europe's basically stuck in a bad loop. Expensive energy, a shrinking economy, and China getting stronger. And Asia? We talked about rationing LPG, but what's the worst-case scenario there?
Complete disruption to oil supply represents a nonlinearity risk. Chetanahia specifically points to the high dependence of Asian economies on Middle Eastern energy, creating a more acute vulnerability than simply higher energy costs. This isn't just about prices, it's about a total supply shock.
A total supply shock? Fantastic. What about the US? Michael Gapin said current oil prices aren't disrupting trends, but $150 barrel would trigger a recession. Is that a realistic threshold?
It is. $150 barrel would trigger demand destruction and a broader asset market weakness. The AI investment cycle is currently robust, but that's contingent on stable energy prices. The US economy has historically shown resilience, but that's contingent on the resumption of ship traffic.
A lot of ifs and contingents. But let's say the worst happens, the strait stays closed, oil hits $150, Europe crashes, Asia stumbles. What does that look like in terms of the chip industry?
This is a hidden vulnerability. South Korea and Taiwan, major suppliers of both consumer electronics and critical chips, rely heavily on natural gas and helium, both impacted by the energy shock. Disruptions in the Middle East could have cascading effects on the AI boom and global tech supply chains.
Wait, so the AI revolution is potentially being undermined by a geopolitical conflict in the Middle East? That feels, I don't know, darkly ironic.
It's a complex interplay of factors. And it's further compounded by consumer sentiment, which has plummeted to a 74-year low. This isn't just an economic issue, it's a psychological one, potentially becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, everyone panics, stops spending, inflation goes up, great. What's the current status of the ceasefire negotiations? Doug Krisner mentioned a 2-week extension won't be enough.
It won't. Comprehensive deal requires months of detailed discussions addressing complex issues like the nuclear file, missile programs, and proxy warfare. The initial truce expires next week, but the likelihood of a significant breakthrough in that timeframe is low.
So we're basically stuck in this limbo, a temporary truce, a looming oil crunch, and a lot of geopolitical uncertainty. What does this mean for private credit? Edward Mills pointed out the differences between liquidity and structural credit events.
It means semi-liquid structures will experience daily volatility, but illiquid funds are less responsive to short-term market sentiment. Private markets offer broader representation of the economy, but shouldn't be exclusively pursued. A balanced portfolio is key.
Balanced portfolio. Very reassuring. Is there any good news here? Anything at all?
Susan Bell frames energy as a human right, and while experiencing acute impact from geopolitical tensions, prioritizes energy above other sectors. The market's current pricing reflects a shift in expectations for rate cuts, now anticipated next year rather than in the near future. However, she also notes that a normalization of oil supplies would be delayed by tanker transit times.
Okay, so energy is important, and interest rates aren't going down anytime soon. Alex, distill all of that into one sentence.
The US-Iran conflict has triggered a fundamental recalibration of risk assessment across global markets, creating a wealth-dependent vulnerability where securing access to and financing of energy supplies, not merely the volume of oil itself, is the primary determinant of economic stability.
Which is just another way of saying we're all completely at the mercy of a few shipping lanes and political calculations. Okay, next up, AI's enterprise revolution and emerging threats. 5,000. That's how many jobs Wall Street banks cut last quarter despite record profits. Seems counterintuitive, right? Let's talk about AI's enterprise revolution and the threats lurking underneath.
It's a stark illustration of the productivity gains and, frankly, the shifting labor landscape. The report highlights that these weren't cuts due to economic downturn, but specifically attributable to AI implementation, particularly in consumer banking with tools like Bank of America's Erica chatbot. The efficiency argument is winning out.
Efficiency, a lovely euphemism for replacing people with algorithms. But it's not just about chatbots. Foundry Labs is applying AI in the legal sector. Drew Bradford suggests a single lawyer could replace an entire team. That's not incremental change, that's systemic disruption.
Consider this, the legal application is telling because it points to a deeper trend, AI compressing innovation timelines. Bradford predicts a 5-year period comparable to the Industrial Revolution, but drastically accelerated. And it's not merely about speed, it's about needing crypto blockchain expertise integrated with AI-powered systems.
A lawyer isn't just using AI to search case files faster, they're using it to what? Validate contracts using blockchain. Predict litigation outcomes based on immutable data. It sounds incredibly complex.
The data tells a story. Blockchain offers a way to record trust, essentially providing tamper-proof verification of AI's output. Think of it as an audit trail for an AI's reasoning, addressing accountability concerns. The renewed focus on blockchain's original purpose, recording transactions for legal work, is almost full circle.
It's like replacing a notary public with a distributed ledger, but with higher stakes. Because if the AI is wrong, the blockchain just proves how wrong it was very publicly. Which leads to the security side. Anthropic's Claude Mythos is powerful but requires careful security design.
Careful security design feels like a massive understatement. The MOU with the Australian government for $3 million in API credits demonstrates a recognition of the need to control access and prevent misuse. But Mark Monfort points out that restricting access is also a marketing strategy, positioning Anthropic as the responsible leader.
Oh, so it's we're so careful with our dangerous AI, you should pay us more to use it. Clever. But restricting access doesn't solve the fundamental problem of human choices. Monfort's point about OpenClaw, humans granting AI excessive permissions, is terrifying.
It reframes the entire risk profile. The AI itself isn't breaking systems, it's the human decision to give it email access or bank account control. Proper infrastructure design limiting AI access is the primary defense. Microsoft is even exploring similar technologies for Copilot.
That's reassuring, until you realize Copilot is already leveraging a comprehensive history of a user's work, email, chat, meetings, a rich dataset for advanced reasoning. It's like giving a digital assistant access to your entire life.
And that access is powerful. Recent updates to Copilot are yielding demonstrably better results, prompting Monfort to suggest a reevaluation for those who previously dismissed it. The tools are evolving so rapidly that past assessments are already obsolete.
Okay, so the tools are getting smarter, faster, and more integrated. But what about the really scary stuff? Quantum computing. Bitcoin's encryption being cracked, that's not a hypothetical problem.
It's a long-term threat, but the industry anticipated it. Mark Monfort notes that blockchains are proactively investing in post-quantum cryptography, with Starkware's scheme representing a crucial first step, even with a current $200 transaction cost for quantum-safe Bitcoin. It's a pattern, critiques of blockchain are often addressed after the industry has already begun working on solutions.
$200 per transaction. Right? So solve all the other problems with Bitcoin, then add a hefty fee to prevent quantum hacking. Feels optimistic.
Optimistic but pragmatic. The cost will likely decrease. The important point is that research is underway, and there's a clear path towards quantum resistance. But more broadly, it underscores the need for continuous security assessment, as highlighted by the UK government's modeling of existential risks.
Existential risks. The UK government is stress testing AI for PDOOM. That's a lot. Meanwhile, Anthropic is securing compute capacity with $30 billion in funding, not because they need it now, but to lock in users and build product stickiness. It's a compute arms race.
It's about control of the infrastructure, and NVIDIA's role in that is crucial. Huang explicitly frames their business model as transforming electrons to tokens, positioning them uniquely against commoditization. It's not about the chips themselves, but the value created by enabling AI.
So NVIDIA isn't selling processors, they're selling potential. And locking in access to the hyperscalers, Anthropic, Google, who control the actual compute power. It's a really weird dependency loop.
Stepping back, NVIDIA's strategy of fostering an environment where instantaneous demand is greater than the total supply of the industry is deliberate. It creates constant pressure for innovation and preemptively addresses supply chain constraints.
Intentionally creating scarcity to drive investment. It feels predatory. And then there's the whole open source angle. China already has significant compute capacity. Is keeping them out of the game even realistic?
Huang believes conceding the Chinese market would be detrimental to long-term U.S. technological leadership, advocating for competition within China instead of restricting access. The idea is to foster a diverse ecosystem and promote innovation through open source initiatives.
Open source, which then gets copied and repurposed by China. It's a high-risk strategy. Let's pivot back to enterprise. Vibe coding apps, Superblocks 2, are emerging as attack vectors.
There's a signal here. Brad Menezes frames these apps as analogous to Shadow AI, and Superblocks 2 is positioned as the solution, emphasizing permissions-based building, auditing, and centralized IT control. Expect a rapid rise in enterprise hardening tools.
The entire enterprise AI strategy hinges on finding the right balance between enabling productivity and preventing digital mayhem.
Essentially, yes.
And that hinges on identifying valuable real-world events and tying them to automated workflows. Greg Eisenberg's product logic: the model is the commodity, the trigger is the product.
Which means it's not about the AI itself, but about the moments it can be applied. It's not enough to have a smart AI, you need to know when to unleash it. And that's where the real value lies. The biggest implication for listeners: successful integration of AI and blockchain in the next 5 years will likely involve blockchain becoming associated with system reliability, trust verification, and a pragmatic acceptance of AI across various industries. Those who don't figure out the triggers will be left behind, and companies prioritizing compute, securing access to the infrastructure will win. But the biggest break: the legal profession. Entire teams are about to disappear, and the remaining lawyers will need to become expert crypto blockchain integrators or face obsolescence. $40 trillion. That's the size of the private credit market, bigger than most people realize. And then you layer on the $5 to $6 trillion expected spend on AI infrastructure. Which force wins, Alex, the existing capital structure or the demand for a totally new one?
It's not necessarily a zero-sum game, Maya, but I'd lean towards the latter with a crucial caveat. Paulo's Jim Zelter points out that the headline $40 trillion figure is heavily skewed by things like commercial and residential real estate. The core direct lending market is closer to $2 trillion. The real story is how capital is flowing within that $40 trillion, and right now, it's being redirected toward investment-grade companies with AI needs.
So less distressed debt, more Intel joint ventures. Because I'm envisioning a future where my credit score is determined by the number of GPUs I own.
The pattern is clear. Apollo's $11 billion partnership with Intel is a prime example. They've raised roughly $150 billion recently from investment-grade firms, signaling that these companies aren't just seeking capital. They're seeking partners to navigate a shift to asset-heavy business models, building data centers, securing supply chains. This is an inflection point. It's about financing the physical infrastructure of AI.
Right, because suddenly the Mag 7 aren't so asset-light anymore. What's the catch? Because Zelter also warned about downside risk in AI investment returns.
The biggest risk isn't the capital availability, it's achieving an acceptable return on that capital. These companies are transitioning from platforms to capital-intensive operations. Think of the entire system as a complex engine. Adding more fuel capital doesn't guarantee increased performance if the engine's components aren't optimized for that fuel, or if the engine's design is flawed. We're potentially facing a misallocation of capital if equity risk isn't carefully priced.
So a glut of data centers built on shaky foundations. I can see it now. Bankrupt server farms, tumbleweeds rolling through the Silicon Valleys of tomorrow, my retirement portfolio vanishing in a puff of processing power, or maybe just a lot of empty office space.
While that's a dramatic scenario, the point is valid. Paulo's focus on origination and sourcing high-quality investments is critical here, especially because a broader market dislocation, the kind that would unlock more compelling investment opportunities, hasn't fully materialized yet as of April 2026. Zelter specifically said that, which is telling.
Dislocation hasn't fully materialized, a polite way of saying everyone's still overpaying. What's the upside if Apollo's bet pays off?
Zelter predicts that by 2035, we'll look back and see this period as an opportunity to finance the world's greatest companies, not as a private credit skirmish. He anchors that prediction to the $5 to $6 trillion needed for data centers alone. It's about scaling up infrastructure globally to support the AI revolution.
Okay, so the big thesis is, private credit isn't a bubble, it's the necessary plumbing for AI. And Apollo wants to own the pipes. Their goal is $1 trillion AUM by the end of 2026, $1.5 trillion by 2029.
It's a telling detail. But remember, AUM growth is a lagging indicator. Their success hinges on identifying and securing deals, originating quality products, particularly during periods of market stress. They're looking for that dislocation.
So to track this, what should listeners watch in the coming week?
Keep a close eye on the Q1 earnings report for NVIDIA, scheduled for May 22nd. Their guidance will offer a real-time pulse on data center demand and capital expenditure trends, giving us an early indication of whether the AI investment cycle is holding strong, or if Zelter's concerns about return on invested capital are beginning to surface.
NVIDIA earnings, because even global geopolitics and the blockchain revolution ultimately depend on whether enough people need more processing power. And next up, we'll explore how Saudi Arabia is positioning itself to capitalize on the coming capital flows. Danny Townsend calls it a two-speed economy in sports. That's a remarkably blunt way to describe the investment landscape, isn't it?
It's a critical observation, actually. He's not suggesting all sports are created equal, but that Tier 1 leagues have a self-reinforcing cycle of investment, while lower tiers struggle with media fragmentation. The SSIC strategy of focusing on leagues, not teams, directly addresses that. It's about acquiring scalable assets, not chasing individual valuations in a fractured market.
Scalable assets. Right up. So less about buying the Yankees, more about owning a piece of the entire MLB broadcast ecosystem.
The implication runs deeper. It's deeply tied to Vision 2040, or rather the acceleration past Vision 2030. Townsend points out they've already hit their initial goals, which shifts the mandate from proving a concept to maximizing impact. That impact isn't solely financial. It's about building a complete sporting ecosystem within Saudi Arabia and boosting participation, especially among women.
Speaking of impact, I'm still hung up on the idea that many investment memorandums are actually showing declining revenue. Sports are attractive despite this, not in spite of it.
The core reason is fan loyalty. Townsend says brands would kill for that level of engagement, even with declining revenue lines. He frames it as AI-proof. Sports inherently foster direct emotional connections that are harder to replicate algorithmically, preserving customer lifetime value.
AI-proof. Okay, that's a new one. But doesn't that rely on a continued ability to capture those fans directly?
So here's the picture. That's why DAZN is so important. It's not about the technology, but its identity as an authentic sports platform. The goal is to bypass the traditional media arbitrage challenge, where streaming services can't sustain previous ARPU levels, and build direct-to-consumer relationships. Traditional media rights are becoming less attractive as a result.
So they're funding the infrastructure to own the fan, not just access them through outdated broadcast models. And a national strategy with 20 priority sports selected, that's not typical venture capital behavior.
We can trace that further. The Ministry of Sport Coordination and the focus on infrastructure development, like an Australian Institute of Sport model, demonstrates a long-term, holistic approach. Townsend emphasizes they're actively engineering cultural shifts, translating inspiration into tangible participation opportunities. The Hatton Al Safe example, from unknown athlete to role model, illustrates that.
It's a 50-year play, he says. And it's driven by leadership that is impatient, meaning they aren't waiting for organic growth. But China, that's a different beast.
Townsend views China as a significant opportunity, but one requiring a structured and aligned investment strategy. The unified vision within Saudi Arabia, a long-term commitment supported by a young population, is a key differentiator that China currently lacks. It's a challenge they haven't solved, and frankly, I don't know how they navigate a market with such a distinct political and cultural landscape. The internal support they have, combined with this unified strategy, isn't easily replicable. That makes the outcome genuinely uncertain.
Uncertain indeed. A long-term commitment built on unique internal dynamics, and now entering a market with fundamentally different rules. But that disruption, the creation of digital economies around participation, feels like the larger wave regardless. That focus on capturing the fan experience feels increasingly crucial as we look at the decentralized software development landscape being pioneered in India. Everyone thought India's tech story was about outsourcing bodies, providing cheap labor for Silicon Valley. Turns out they're building their own AI superpower. Let's talk about India's ascent and this surprisingly decentralized approach to software creation.
Something to flag here, the $1.2 billion AI mission and the projected $5 to $6 billion total investment is significant, but the real story isn't just the money, it's the strategic shift to building domestic capabilities, particularly in compute infrastructure. Abhishek Singh highlighted that this isn't about replicating ChatGPT, it's about uniquely Indian solutions.
Uniquely Indian solutions. Translation, apps that handle 1,000 languages and don't crash when someone asks for tuberculosis diagnosis. What's interesting is they're doing this while apparently avoiding the talent drain issue.
Worth noting, the Centers of Excellence initiative is key there, dismantling research silos and incentivizing experts to return with R&D grants. They're actively addressing what Singh calls the training ground effect, where India developed engineers for other nations.
So labs, compute, long-term research culture, things China apparently figured out a while ago with their national moonshot approach. How are they planning to compete then if they're not trying to do a straight-up arms race?
By lowering the barrier to entry for everyone else. The $1 USD per GPU per hour subsidy is huge, and the AI Kosh, the National Data Repository, isn't just a storage system, it's an ecosystem designed to make data usable and protect privacy. They're looking at the entire stack.
A usable data stack. Okay. And this is where Replit comes in, right? Jack Neal's whole argument is that coding is becoming optional.
Two things stand out. He frames idea generation as the new bottleneck. AI agents are already at a mid-level Facebook engineer level, automating much of the development process. The lean startup mantra of endless market research is being flipped on its head. Speed of concept is critical.
Meaning, if you have a good idea, you can build a working prototype without knowing a single line of code. So a previously wasted talent, the terminally online, the people with ADHD who notice trends, are now potential startup founders.
That's the surprising implication. It fundamentally shifts the valuation of tech skills, threatening the premium on a four-year computer science degree. Neil compares it to the Gutenberg Press democratizing literacy, suggesting this could have a similar impact on software creation.
So less competition from the big guys, but more of an existential threat to the idea of elite programming education. What's the timeline on this, realistically?
According to Neil, we're at an inflection point this year. He believes the best AI models are only a few months ahead of what's publicly accessible, thanks to rapid decentralization. And importantly, increasing availability from China.
So India's not trying to hoard AI. They're leveraging global access to lower the barrier at home and focus on practical, DPI-driven solutions. If that continues, we might see a shift in power dynamics, where India becomes a global AI use case repository, not just a service provider. The question now is, will this bottomless funding, the Prime Minister's as-needed approach, be enough to sustain that momentum, especially if the initial $1.2 billion disappears in 3 years? Looking back at everything, the tensions in the Middle East, the AI land grab, Saudi Arabia's ambitious build-out, India's surprising move, and the sheer weight of private credit sloshing around, it feels like we're not just seeing separate events, but facets of a single, increasingly urgent reordering. It's as if access to physical resources, and the capacity to pay for them, is rapidly becoming the primary axis of global power.
And that access isn't simply geological, it's computational. The energy markets are signaling a fundamental disconnect. A paper oil is fine, real oil is not dynamic, while the compute infrastructure powering AI is experiencing an instantaneous demand greater than the total supply of the industry. What's striking is how capital is flowing towards securing that physical foundation. The $5 to $6 trillion projected spend on AI infrastructure, the redirection of $40 trillion in private credit. It's not about the algorithms themselves, but about owning the electricity, the data centers, the GPUs.
And let's be clear, it's not a level playing field. Saudi Arabia's strategy, as we discussed, is about building an emotional moat, something algorithms can't easily replicate, while India's subsidy model, offering $1 USD per GPU per hour, is a strategic attempt to leapfrog conventional competition by fostering domestic innovation. They're both recognizing that the ability to control the use cases will be as important as the underlying technology.
And that brings us to the crux of it, the tension between centralized control and decentralized creation. China, with its inherent structural complexities, risks falling behind India's more agile training ground approach. Meanwhile, the potential for AI-driven job displacement, the PDUM scenario, is becoming increasingly real, dependent on the speed of accessibility. The $1.2 billion AI mission investment in India is a test case for a genuinely new model.
But it's also deeply risky. We talked about the actual value of private credit, whether that $40 trillion is representative of real health or inflated bubbles. And all of this relies on a fundamental assumption that AI investment returns will materialize. If NVIDIA's earnings on May 22nd are disappointing, that could be a major inflection point.
It's a cinematic composition of converging forces. Imagine a long shot of a rising tide, the global energy demand, while in the foreground, multiple actors are frantically building seawalls, Saudi Arabia, India, Apollo, even Anthropic with its $30 billion compute capacity funding. The question isn't just who builds the best wall, but whether enough walls can be built before the tide overwhelms the system.
And with consumer sentiment at a 74-year low and inflation stubbornly clinging on at 3.3%, we're looking at a scenario where even small shocks, oil hitting $150 a barrel, could trigger a broader cascade. It's not just about the ifs and contingents anymore. It's about recognizing that we're entering a period of genuine systemic vulnerability.
Ultimately, this is a period of recalibration. A recalibration of risk assessment, of geopolitical strategies, and of our understanding of what constitutes economic power. It's unsettling, certainly. And truthfully, the long-term sustainability of India's funding remains an open question.
But it's also incredibly dynamic. Thanks for joining us today.
And thanks to you, Maya. We'll be watching those NVIDIA earnings very closely and unpacking what they mean for the future right here tomorrow.